And so Mary Tsukamoto, I don't know if you have heard of her, but her husband, she and her husband are Y leaders up in San Francisco. They happen to be in our camp, and a few of us talked with her, and she said, I think it's a fine idea. I said, she said, you help us and we'll write hand notes and distribute them to all of the homes in our block. And if this catches on, the other blocks will want to come and join us. So we said, well, set a time, say 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we would meet at a certain block. And then we got the women together and they all gathered, but they didn't know what they came for. And Mary, being a Y leader, she knew just what to do. She had each person stand up, give their name, and where they came from, Los Angeles or San Bernardino or what town. Told about what occupation they did. She had a secretary help, and she wrote the information down as fast as she could. And then we numbered off 1, 2, 1, 2, and the twos got together on one side, the ones on one side, and we started to play games. And then we thought that we would schedule something more interesting for the next meeting. And that's how we got the women together for fun once a week. And with the high school groups, why we also appointed a leader. And they would have different ones from different schools in different departments that have made a research or a study in a certain subject to talk. And if it was forestry or biology or anatomy, whatever subject they wanted to talk about, answer and discussion period. And that way we kept order. We also made it instructive and interesting. And with the Y group, we had a regular Y meeting. And eventually, when we heard that the war was progressing, we heard that outside the Ys were organizing ROTC get-togethers, and they were entertaining the soldiers. And so we said, well, we heard that there was a big group of these soldiers down in Shelby, Camp Shelby, which isn't too far from here. And on weekends, we saw 2 or 3 coming to camp. They had relatives or parents in camp, but a lot of them were from Hawaii. And a lot of them had no relatives. Their relatives were either in Amachi, Colorado camp, or in some other camp. So I said, well, how about those boys? They must be lonesome. And I think they're entitled to some kind of entertainment and have a little good time. So we went we rode to Little Rock, where the ROTC headquarters were, or the Y headquarters. And we told them what we wanted, and they sent a representative. And we told them exactly what we wanted. We asked our project manager if we could have a vacant barrack to use for a recreation center. And Mr. Taylor was very helpful and understanding, so he said, yes, I'll give you one. But he had no money allotted for furnishing it. So we put cots in there, and we took curtains that we bought, or drapes, or bed spreads that we had, and fixed it all up to look like a nice lounge. And then we asked the ROTC headquarters if they could allot a little money to us. They gave us $75 a month. And with that money, they went to the canteen. And they didn't have much to offer, but we could buy a few cans of sardines and Kool-Aid. Tea, I think. So we could boil water. Went to the mess hall and asked them for any kind of leftover rice they had. And there were a lot of open fields out by the forest, so we'd go out there and gather dandelion greens and that wild daikons, wild radish, and you just pick the tips and brought it back and make sort of a sauerkraut or a pickle-like. And we fixed all these little things that they could eat for snacks. And the sardines you cut into little pieces and we put them out for the men to snack on. And made lots of hot tea. And then we asked the girls if they would come and be partners and entertain the soldiers. And we sent word to Camp Shelby to allow the men to come. And the first ones came in two buses. And they were so happy to come. We introduced them to the girls. And they were dancing. Some would rather sit and talk about their parents. And we told them they wanted us to write to the parents in English. We could write English. We could find someone who could write in Japanese if their parents couldn't read English, and send messages to them. So even if they were sent overseas, why, they could use us as a go-between to communicate for them. So that's the kind of work we did. And then sometimes they invited us down there. So a lot of the school teachers we had were American teachers. And there was all young teachers. So we took about six American teachers. We took about four of the people in our camp. One was a woman Buddhist minister, Mrs. Yamashita, and Dr. Ikuto's wife. She was a Y worker from Hawaii. And we had Mrs. Tsukamoto, and we had another lady. I've forgotten so many of the names. But anyway, we had about 12 hosts to go with us to look after the girls. And we assured the parents that their girls would be well taken care of. So we went down in buses that were furnished. And we showed the boys a good time. And I had these get-togethers, I think maybe six times. And then the boys were sent overseas. They couldn't tell us when they were going. We didn't know. We just said that they were discontinuing the bus. That was all we heard. Then we knew that they were overseas. And I remember the last, one of the last letters I got was from a sergeant that we entertained. And he said, would you please send some writing paper and some ink and some stamps. Was it stamps? No. Something else. And I sent it, and it came back. It was returned. He had been one of the first victims of tragedies. So it seems that as soon as they landed, they were right in the middle of all of this. But I'm glad that for the little time we had spent together, it was present memories that they could remember. We tried to do what we could. And $75 didn't go very far. I remember going from house to house asking for a 10-cent donation. And some of the women, they would look at me and question me and say, are you on the American side or the Japanese side? I said, it's to help our own boys. I said, they are working for the American government so that you and I can be outside free. And we had to explain all of this to them. And it was years afterwards in Los Angeles I went shopping. And I met one of the mothers. And her son was killed overseas. And she said, oh, I'm so glad that you did what you did for the boys. She said, he often wrote to his sister and said that those meetings that you held in camp, he remembers them so well. He was so happy that we had to get together. So that was our experience in camp. But the schools were organized in the meantime, and we had wonderful teachers who came to help us, and we had some of our own college people in camp, who offered to volunteer and teach. And we had a wonderful principal, too. So my little boy was four, and I thought, well, as long as I'm going to send him to school and have to look after him, I might as well volunteer for a kindergarten teacher. So I went along every day, and I, my friend Marie and I, we had 30 little children we took care of. And then at noontime, we came home, had lunch, and then we went back until 3 o'clock. And that's how we spent our days. But in the summertime, and their summers begin rather early. I think this time it was just really hot and muggy. It's so close to the Mississippi River, you know, in the valley. And I would get up 5 o'clock and do a batch of washing. And if I didn't get up that early, there weren't enough wash trays available because we had to scrub our hair. So I'd get out one washing. Then at lunchtime when I'd come back, by then I'd soak another batch. Then when I'd come back, I'd do that washing. But it was quite an experience. And in the wintertime, they had these narrow roads on both sides of the ditches, and it would freeze over. And if we didn't watch, our step would slide into the ditch.
How long was it?
I was there a year and a half in Arkansas. And then the camps had to sort of consolidate because they asked for, they drafted a lot of our boys. The laws were being changed, and they drafted the boys. And so some went into the service, and some went into defense work. And my boy, being mechanically inclined, he went into defense work and was sent to Chicago. And the camps, some of the blocks were becoming vacant, so they said that they were going to consolidate them. And in Arkansas, they had two camps. They had Roar and Jerome. I was in Jerome. And then they closed our camp. And my daughter, oh, she graduated high school when she was 15. And then they had a sort of ceremony in Santa Anita. And then in camp, she was only 16, so I didn't want her to leave then. And then by 17, I received word that she had received a Presbyterian scholarship. She went to our church, and she was in the choir, and they gave her a Presbyterian scholarship. I asked them to recommend a good family in Worcester, Ohio. And so Worcester College in Ohio is a Presbyterian-related college. And they said that they would introduce me to this professor and his wife. They were both professors. Dr. Ellsworth, professor of Latin American history, and Mrs. Ellsworth was a child psychologist. And they had three children of their own. And they would love to have a young girl to come and to help with the work, and she would be allowed so many hours for her own study. And the college was next, right near. And Professor Ellsworth was the professor there. So I thought that would be a very good place to entrust my daughter, so I sent her there. I knew she was safe. I knew that she was getting in the right environment. And she lived there, and so when I heard they were going to close the Jerome, I didn't know where I was going after that. So I wanted to make a quick trip to meet the people, to see the conditions under which she was living, and all about her. So I asked permission to go out, and I went and stayed with her a week. And I found they were such wonderful people. I came back very happy to report to my husband. And when I came back the 13th of June, most of the people had all left already. we were going to leave, and my husband said, I think it's better go closer to California instead of going to Chicago or some place. We had no jobs, and with the children small, I said we should go closer to California because my father had just passed away, and Reverend Nicholson had taken the ashes back to Pasadena, to their hometown, and had conducted a funeral for us. And my mother was widowed, and my brother was just itching to go out of camp, so he said, oh, please come, stay with Mama. So we went to Arizona, and I knew that was a better climate for my husband, and I knew that somehow the children would be all right. So that's where we went from Jerome, Arkansas to California. And we spent a year and a half there. And instead of teaching school, I applied for a job, and they gave me a job as property control, in the property control office. So I took care of all the property in the camp. I had a list of all the cars in the carpool. I had to know where each truck and car was. The personal property the government had rented out to the personnel, like the beds, the furniture, the refrigerators, and the ovens, and the draperies, and things like that. And I kept books on that. Of course, I had the government manual to go by, so I learned that quickly. And I worked there for a year and a half. But a lot of the other people worked on camouflage nets. I don't know if you know what they are, but they're like fish nets, and they string them with pieces of burlap of all different colors. And I think they just throw those over some installation to camouflage their place. But they were working on these camouflage nets. So we were there for a year and a half, which went through. And then they started gradually closing up. And then I made arrangements to come back to California because my mother had her home there where they lived for since 1904. And we came back, and I thought, oh, man, this is going to be a job. But I was telling my mother everything. For the first night, we'll make out somehow. The next day, we'll just furnish our bedroom, and then we'll buy him the other stuff in, but I want you to be comfortable in my way, and I want the children to be safe. My husband's all right, because the hospital notified me that they would transport him and take care of him, and they would let me know where he would be. So after I arrived, he passed me to the home of the county hospital in Los Angeles. So I went to visit him there. And there were so many patients there, and I don't think they could get about to give each one very much attention. But I told him I'd visit him as much as I could and try to bring him what he needed. And then in the meantime, they transferred him to it was way up in the mountains, north of Los Angeles. So I went there to visit him. It was an old Jewish hospital that they vacated for our use. And he was there until he passed away. So a young minister, he just was ordained during the war, and he came back and he visited me in my Long Beach house, and he said, I would be glad to go up and get your husband. He wants to come back home just for once. I said, I can't blame him. So I said, if his condition will permit, I would like to have him come. And he brought him home, and he stayed over one night. He's supposed to be in bed, but he was so happy. He walked through the house, walked through the yard, then came back and rested. And then the next morning, Reverend Cano came and picked him up and took him back. And 3 days later, he was gone. He was so weak. But he came back and he saw the house. And then after that, I thought, well, Raymond was about 7, I guess, by that time. What am I going to do, raising 5 children on my own? And what am I going to do for a living? I was just so worried and frustrated. But I guess the good Lord was watching over us. We seemed to get a job of some kind. And I think the federal government had informed different places of employment that we were to be treated fairly, and that the law would see to it that no harassment or discrimination was allowed. So we had no trouble. And the children in school, I was worried about that too. But they didn't bother the children. And by that time, my little boy was 15. They were 15 and 7 or 8. They were beginning to understand, said, would the kids throw stones at us, or would they hurt us in any way? I said, no. I said, we didn't do any wrong, and if anything happens, just tell the teacher that you would like to come home because you weren't happy, and the teacher would understand. Don't point to anybody, don't hurt anybody back. I said, just tell the teacher that you weren't too happy, you wanted to go home, and she would understand. So that's what they did. That's what I told them, but nothing happened. They said the children were very good to them. They made friends, and everything was so harmonious. So I was very happy for that, because that was a big problem. I couldn't work and worry about the children, too. And my older boys, they got waiter jobs. And one got a job at the Todd Shipyards. And I've been on that way for a few years. So gradually everything seemed to take its place.
How did you find your house when you came back? Was it just as you had left it?
No, I had to stay in Pasadena for a year because the family asked me if I could, if they could stay. But I came back in September, and then I notified the family that I rented it to, that I was back. I was living with my mother. And I would like to have the house back so they could find a place to go, but I wouldn't pressure them. I said, you'll look for a place to go as soon as you're ready by just phone me. I gave her the telephone number. And she called me one day and she said, we're looking, but we haven't found anything. I said, well, I have the children in school now, but as long as we're here, I would like to have them finish out the school year, which would be the next following June. So I said, be sure that you have until June to find a place. And she was glad because her girls had jobs around the house on Pacific Avenue. And she said she wanted to find a house nearby. So she let me know, and when I came back, it wasn't the same at all. But she apologized, and she said, I didn't do it, and I believe she didn't. She said that it was the first couple who were there. And the first couple were elderly couple, and had a nice young couple who wanted to come in. But I thought, well, if I rent it to a younger couple, they might want repairs and paint jobs, and I couldn't afford to have them. Do that for them, and they might change their minds and want to move out. But if an older couple went in, they might want to stay. I could be more relieved then. And she assured me
should take good care. But she said, my husband and I just retired from the restaurant business. But, you know, in the meantime, the oil business was getting so busy, and the shipyard was getting so busy, that a lot of laborers came into Long Beach, and they were looking for rooms. And being in the restaurant business, she was a good cook. So she must have advertised a room with board and room or something. That's the way I imagined I shouldn't survive on anything. But anyway, she had the living room rented, the dining room, and every bedroom. And she and her husband slept in the breakfast nook. Put a bed in the breakfast nook, and he slept there in the daytime, because he worked at night at Bethlehem, and I guess she did the cooking for the men. And every room was just awful, so dirty, walls all dirty. And my neighbor was telling me that her vendor told her, said they had their junk cars all over. And I believe it, because even after I had a nice fish pond out in the back, right up to the fish pond, I could see these mounds of dirt and big blotches of black oil where they had parked their cars, about four or five big stains on their pavement. And anyway, the bathroom toilets, I don't know how they could do that, but those heavy porcelain toilets were cracked and the water was seeping out, not enough to flood, but enough to keep the floor wet. And the shower was used so much that this plaster had all fallen out. And I don't know what kind of weeds or grass, but there was some kind of green stuff growing out between the laths. It was so musty in there. I thought, how could they have lived like this? So then afterwards, when we finally got into the place, I told my boy, we have to do something about the plumbing. We have to go to a secondhand place and find some clean toilets and replace those, because I can't have water on the floor. It's going to go through and wreck the foundation. So I went to Wilmington and we found a junkyard. We found two toilets that would work. And he's pretty handy, so my son installed those. And then, in the meantime, my son came back from overseas, and he was looking around. He says, oh, we can't live like this. The shower is awful. I said, I pulled all the weeds out, but I said, it's still musty. And I said, I can't get the mold off. He said, well, he says, I know what I'll do. And he chipped all that off, and he put an electric heater in the bathtub and dried it out. Dried it out the best we could. And then he tore it all out, you know, and put walls in. So it was 2 or 3 years before we really got it into place. And the floor, I think, they had dogs, because it was stained. It was hardwood, all hardwood floors. And I used to polish them like mad, you know, on my hands and knees. But they had stains. I just couldn't get it out. My neighbor, mother's neighbor in Pasadena, is a carpenter, and he said TSP should take it out. I don't know what that is, but it's in a can. He put that out and said, it won't take it out. He said, I think you'll have to have water wall rugs, because the stains were mostly toward the edge, and with a regular rug, it couldn't cover it. So we had to wait, and we had to get some cheap water wall rugs to cover that. But I said, well, at least the house wasn't burned down, and we have to be thankful for what we have. And I said, don't look back, but look forward, and everything will be all right. That's a philosophy we adopted.
Is that what you nailed up in the garage? still?
No, most of it was gone. Just the old dresser. The old dresser and the children's clothes and some of the things that I was sentimental with, you know, like children's yearbooks and the papers they had written and different manuscripts that they had written, I wanted to keep, so I had a box of those, and they were all broken open and scattered, but they were there, but I couldn't keep them. They were so dirty. Then there was a door in the back, too, for entrance, and they had torn that off the hinges, so it was wide open to the alley. And nice vases and dishes, and little art things, they were all taken, things that people could use. And some of the old mattresses were left. Some of you saw the watch, you could buy newer ones. But like I said, they didn't start a fire. And it caused a lot of time, but and it could have been worse. So little by little, we managed to fix it up. And we went back to the family.
And?
Yes.
Did you work in Long Beach then?
I worked in Long Beach. My old boss took me back. I was a bookkeeper for the Long Beach French Hand Laundry and Curtain Cleaning Companies down at 1340 Redondo Avenue. It's right off the corner of Anaheim and Redondo. I think it's still there. I don't go down that way much, but it's still there. I went back to work for him. I worked there for several years afterwards.
Did you know other Japanese people who returned to Long Beach after they got out of camp?
I guess there were quite a few, yes. But I think their business was sold and they worked for other people. And we were more or less busy renovating our houses and looking for jobs. We didn't have much time to socialize. So just when we heard that they had passed away or they were sick, I would try to locate them and visit them, but otherwise we didn't have many get-togethers for many years.
How about the church? Did it
not for several years, because, you know, the Boys Club had it, and it was all broken up, too. They had it for a year after we came back, because I think they had a lease on it. And after they moved, we had to do a lot of painting and plastering and fixing. I don't remember the exact date when it came back. But it wasn't until just about 10 years ago we had the sanctuary fixed. It looks very nice now.
One of the things that you talked about Japanese people doing in the 20s and the 30s in Long Beach is selling art goods, Oriental art goods. And I wonder if you could explain specifically what that is, what that means, what they did.
Well, we had two stories. In those days, the Pike was quite a place down by the ocean. It was a place where tourists came, and Sundays most of us with families used to go down there because it had ice cream stands, merry-go-rounds, and hot dog stands, so many things for children and adults to entertain them. We had the Oriental shop, and it was called the Orient. I see the wife every once in a while, or every week, who owned that. She's in her 60s, but 6 or 7 years ago, they had to sell because it's getting kind of rough, and she sold the business. And the other business was further down, I forgot what they called it, but it was owned by Mr. and Mrs. Cunnell, and they lived here upon Lyme Avenue.
And Mrs. Kano is one of the pillars of our church. She was there from the very beginning, and her son is Reverend Kano. One of her sons is a minister. And you can tell how time flies. Her son is a retired minister now. He just retired. I said, I can't believe it. But the Connors had one very good store. They things imported from Japan. They didn't have the high tariff and the surtax and all of this attached to it. So we used to get a lot of beautiful embroidered kimonos, screens, the embroidered screens, lacquered trays, and beautiful vases and lamps and nests of tables and things like that, and ivory carvings and all the ornamental things of that type. And it was quite popular in those days to get oriental things. I think the people who bought things in those days and are keeping them are lucky, because they've gone so much in value, and the old craftsmen don't make them anymore in Japan. My father had a shop in Pasadena, and he used to sell to people like the Schwabs in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. One time he sold a whole room full of artifacts and screens and statues. And Mr. Schwab invited him as a guest to come back and turn this one room in his mansion into an oriental room. And he installed all these things in their proper place, in a proper atmosphere. And then when he came back, he said he has that beautiful room, a show place back there. So, and they have imitations, they have things that turn out in mass now by machinery, but they never can take the place of the original, the older type of things. They were beautiful.
Where did the people get their dolls?
Well, many of the Japanese stores on First Street, they call it Little Tokyo, they're specialized in dolls. Especially they call it Hinamatsuri dolls. Hinamatsuri. And they sold them in stores. But it's lucky, it means luck to a family if a grandmother or an aunt or somebody in Japan buys it and sends it to them. And so they price it more. And they were quite expensive when they buy them. So most of them are sent by relatives in Japan. And a lot of times, the families would want a special dice doll. They had some, not only the ones on the stands, but other dolls that represented storybooks and the Japanese legends. And I had a few of those too. I never knew what they meant until my mother explained them. And then they seemed to increase in value for me. They had a better meaning for me. And they would send money to their relatives to buy a certain type of doll. And so that's what they did. And the a doll, the elderly couple doll, that they call the, I can't see the name when I want to. Anyway, it shows the older gentleman raking leaves and the older lady sweeping. And I thought it was just as it looks, you know, they were doing gardening work. But it was explained to me, my mother says, that's what you think of this, isn't it? That they're cleaning the yard. She said, no. She said, it has a better meaning. They are raking all the wonderful memories of their past years in life. The grandmother is sweeping together all the wonderful memories and reminiscing with her husband about all the wonderful things that happened in their lifetime. That's the meaning of this. And so they give these things as gifts to people who celebrate their golden anniversary. And I belong cultural at the Kaiser Fujinkai, the women's organization of language. And we had two couples who celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary. And it was at a gift that we went to Los Angeles to look for. You know, the wife has pure white hair. She has a parted in the middle and just draped, cascading down her back. Sweetest things. So, and then another one that I remember was a young samurai. A samurai is a nobleman. And on a rainy day, he was traveling in the country. And he came by his farmhouse. And there was just a young girl in the house. And he came and knocked to ask if he could borrow a raincoat and a rain hat. They call it a mino, the combination of the hat. It's a kind of, it's a cape. But the old custom is you never say no. If someone asks you, would you loan me a cape in this bad weather, she couldn't say no because she didn't have any. The ones that she had, her parents were wearing them out in the field, and she didn't have any available. But instead, she presented him with this bouquet of flowers. It's a small yellow chrysanthemum that grows wild. And it has a pith in the middle. And then it's called the mino. This flower is called the mino. I don't know why they named it that. And so she said that the flower is called the mino and the pith inside is, so has a negative name. But it, so she said, no, she has no mino. So she ran in the house and she brought this flower, a bouquet out, and she presented it to him. And he was outside of her house receiving it. And I said, now why is that man receiving flowers from a girl? It should be the other way around, I told my mother. And she said, see there, you don't understand the story. Then she told me. I said, oh, so that's it. So there are different interesting pictures, you know, that represent these different legends or stories in Japan. So I thought that was interesting. And there's so many others. I wished I had paid more attention and had collected more of it. When you're young, you know, things your mother tells you goes in one ear out the
other. I have another question about the old days of Long Beach.
Oh.
I found something in a directory. All of the Japanese people in Long Beach didn't all have land of their own. Were some of them just workers who worked for the people who either rented the land or farmed it on shares?
Not any that I know of. Most of them are leased or subleased.
I found something that there was an employment agency.
Oh.
But you didn't know about that?
You mean employment agency run by Japanese?
Yeah, it was called the Japanese Employment Agency.
Yes, we had one, I remember. It was called the Ohio Employment Agency. It was on American Long Beach Boulevard, around Florida Ford. And I believe it was like a boarding house, and then they also had this agency service. So they would stay there, like single men, and who had no families. They lived there, and then when a telephone call would come in, if they wanted a houseboy or they wanted someone to guarding, the owner would tell these boarders, and whoever was available or whoever was trained for a certain job would take that, or as a cook in a family. So we had that, yeah.
And there was something called the Japanese Relief Society. I wonder if that was just another arm of the Japanese Association.
I think so. I had never heard that. We just had to be called the Japanese Association.
Well, they had an office on Pine.
You heard?
1752 Pine.
Oh, I don't remember that. Our place was 1748 Molino.
Yeah.
Yes.
And But this wasn't connected with
No.
And were there Japanese people who were professionals, attorneys, or?
In Los Angeles, yes.
Sitting out in Los Angeles.
Yes. But I knew two, Mr. Abbey and also Mr. Taniguchi. They were graduates of a law school, and they had a degree and everything, but they were not allowed to practice, you know, present their cases in court. And so they used to prepare all the briefs, interview all their clients, prepare everything, and then they'd have to hand it to the American lawyer, and he would present it in court. And so